despair says nobody cares. And that's not true.
Dr. Christian Kincaid, author of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort.
And despair says there's no hope for me. And that's not true. To despair is not of God.
Learn more about living with grief at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040.
The great thing about being tolerant is that you can do that from your couch. You know, you can just lay there and do nothing, and you're successfully tolerating everything in the world. It doesn't really require anything of you.
It's important to understand that what begins as discrimination becomes secularization. You can't have a system where you legally privilege one religion without causing blowback.
The problem is if you go into marriage with this false ideal of self-actualization, then if you don't get that self-actualization, you've got your built-in excuse to quit.
The answer to despair is God's word, living, mighty, efficacious. The answer to despair is our baptism. The answer to despair is the Holy Supper.
College students graduating during COVID-19, love issues, etc.
It's a fascinating story in the Old Testament, the story of Esther. It's not only about Esther, it's also about a man named Mordecai and a man named Haman and a Persian king. It's a true story, of course, but it reads like a kind of palace intrigue novel in a lot of ways. It has all those elements. It falls into kind of a subgenre of literature in the Old Testament shared by Daniel and the story of Joseph. A lot of similarities there. How does it point us toward Christ, and where is God in the story of Esther? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll be remembering Esther with Dr. Kevin Golden here in the first half hour. Then it's our feature This Week in Pop Christianity. Rick Wilkerson Jr. has preached a sermon on the 12 spies in Numbers 13 of 14. Pastor Chris Roseborough will be alongside to walk us through some of that a little bit later. Joining us to remember Esther from the Old Testament, Dr. Kevin Golden, pastor of Village Lutheran Church in St. Louis. He has a PhD in biblical studies with an emphasis on the Old Testament from Concordia Seminary. Dr. Golden, welcome back.
Good to be with you as always.
This book holds a pretty big part in Jewish theology, but if you would compare and contrast the place that the book of Esther has in Jewish theology with its place in Christian theology.
Well, of course, both hold Esther in a very positive light and for much the same reason, but as even you noted, in Judaism, it's a much higher place. In fact, this is the beginning of the Festival of Purim, which is still observed to this day within Judaism, falls typically during the month of February. That's a rather fun holiday in many ways in Judaism, because as they recount the story of Esther, when the main antagonist, that would be Haman, is mentioned, as the story is being read, people will hiss and such. But then when the two protagonists, that'd be Mordecai and Esther, are brought up, there's cheering and clapping and such. And so it has a much bigger role within Judaism than in Christianity. But nevertheless, in Christianity still, Esther has a place of significance. Somewhat limited in that, well, Esther's never, it's one of the few books of the Old Testament that's not directly quoted within the New Testament, and so not quite the same level of prominence. Should have a bit more prominence, at least on the world stage in recent days. Just last week, there was news that on the 14th of May, the tomb of Mordecai and Esther that sits in Iran, which is the modern-day equivalent of Persia, where this takes place, where the account of Esther takes place, that tomb of Mordecai and Esther was actually subjected to arson. And it was interesting that it was on the 14th day of May, which is the anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel, and so there's a little bit of political fallout from that. Aside from the politics, of course, that would be concerning to all those who would rightly recognize that Esther was one of our matriarchs in the faith.
Esther shares a motif with several other Old Testament accounts, and I can think off the top of my head accounts of Daniel and in Genesis of Joseph. How is this one related to those others?
Well, there's a nice tie with both of those. You can start off, let's go with the earlier one, Joseph. And here Joseph is suffering in a foreign land, and that's one of the common themes between these three, Joseph, Daniel, and Esther. All three are faithful individuals who are living in a foreign land, and in some way their lives are put in jeopardy. You remember Joseph, he's thrown into prison while he is there, even though he had served so faithfully under Potiphar. So his life is in danger. Then you have Daniel also, who is serving faithfully during the reign of the Babylonians, much the same land as what Esther is serving in, but with Daniel, he was serving under the Babylonians, whereas Esther is in the time of the Persians, who had overthrown the Babylonians. So there's that common motif about being in a foreign land and yet going about your life faithfully. That's yet another thing that ties them together, is that even though they're in these perilous circumstances, they remain steadfast and devout, because you have Joseph, who refuses to fall prey to the temptations that are set before him by Potiphar's wife. Daniel, who will refuse to stop praying, as the edict had come forth that no one was to pray except to the emperor himself. Esther remains faithful in the face of difficulty also. Yet one more thing that ties them together is each one also has this theme of God's faithfulness, taking care of his people through whatever is going on around them. And with that theme of faithfulness, it's even done to the point that God elevates them to a place of prominence. So you'll remember Joseph becomes the number two man in all of the land of Egypt. Esther's cousin, Mordecai, the other big protagonist of this book, he becomes number two man to Xerxes himself here in the book of Esther. So a lot of continuities between them. But the number one we'd want to really put on there is the Lord's faithfulness in the midst of all of this.
This is the big question. Where is God in the book of Esther?
Yeah, this is a famous question because of all the books of the Bible, it is the one in which God is not explicitly mentioned. But you can rightly say that God is present throughout the text, working through the faithful who are there, Mordecai and Esther, but working, if you will, kind of behind the scenes. And it's also apparent that Esther and Mordecai know that the Lord is at work. For example, in chapter 4, Mordecai says to Esther, when he's calling her to step forward and act on behalf of God's people, of course he doesn't even refer to them as God's people, but he tells them, hey, if you don't step forward and do this, the Jews are going to be delivered. So he just knows they're going to be delivered. And what you hear behind that is his confidence in God's fidelity to his own promises to his people, that he's going to lift them up along the way. So one thing that this does so nicely for us is it teaches us to anticipate that God is always at work behind the scenes. Even if you cannot see it, he is at work because he is there to be faithful to his promises, that he's going to deliver his people and provide for them.
You mentioned this in passing a moment ago, but when and where is the book of Esther set?
So as you read the text, it mentions that this is during the reign of Ahasuerus. And for those who are schooled in ancient history, you'll know him more as Xerxes. It's really the same name, just kind of taken into different languages and slightly different pronunciation. So during the reign of Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as it is here in this text, that would have been in the 5th century that this takes place. And the text also says that this is largely taking place in the city of Susa, which is one of the various capitals of the Persian Empire at the time. It was the winter capital. It's where the Xerxes would have gone during the winter to spend those months and such.
How does Esther come to be a wife, or perhaps in this case we should say concubine, of the Persian king?
Xerxes' wife, Vashti, is called by Xerxes to come and present herself to a group of the leading men of Persia who he has present for a great banquet. By the way, that's another theme in this whole book, is banqueting and great feasts that are taking place. But he has these prominent men who are gathered together for a days-long feast, and he asks Vashti to come in and present herself because he's going to show off how beautiful his wife is. She declines. She refuses to go in, and as a result, she's deposed. Xerxes says you can no longer be queen. In fact, a lot of pressure is put on him in that regard, essentially saying, Hey, Xerxes, if people hear that even you, that your wife is not willing to do what you tell her to do, what is that going to do for all the women of Persia and how they're going to treat their husbands? So you got to use this as a chance to set the tone. And so he deposes her. She can no longer be queen. And so now they begin a process of selecting a new queen, one who's going to wear the crown. And Esther ends up being selected because she is deemed to be the most beautiful. It's interesting, actually, the Greek historian Herodotus mentions that Xerxes was known for having kind of a weakness for beautiful women, and that was always something that was able to get hold of him, and certainly it plays out in this text itself.
Dr. Kevin Golden is our guest. We're remembering Old Testament Esther. When we come back, we'll get into the palace intrigue and conspiracies. Are you still grieving, even months after the passing of someone in your life? The effects of grief, loss, and mourning are long-lived, even if it seems the rest of the world has moved on. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or look for Living with Grief at issuesetc.org. When you purchase Living with Grief, be sure to request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
A mobile Lutheran Bible study. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're remembering Esther from the Old Testament. Dr. Kevin Golden is our guest. He has a PhD in Biblical Studies with an emphasis on Old Testament from Concordia Seminary. Here is what Pastor Ernie Lassman recently wrote about LCMS ministry to the armed forces. He writes, "This is an important service to our military men and women who often serve under stress and even put their lives on the line for us. Learn more about the work of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces at lcms.org/armed forces, serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armed forces. So, Dr. Golden, if you would, tell us about the palace intrigue and conspiracy that follows.
Esther is selected to be now wearing the queenly crown. She does not reveal that she happens to be Jewish. And so another man who rises to prominence is by the name of Haman. Haman, from the word go, you can anticipate things are not going to go well because it's mentioned that he is an Agagite. That means he's a descendant of Agag, who was king of the Amalekites. And you may recall the Amalekites were the people who really gave the people of Israel during the Exodus, as they're heading to the Promised Land, refused to let them pass through their land. And God said, hey, there's always going to be animosity now, and he's going to hold the Amalekites to account for refusing passage to his people. And so this is really a kind of a playing out of that in many ways. And so you shouldn't be surprised when Haman ends up taking a negative view on the Jewish people. It all begins when Esther's cousin Mordecai refuses to show obeisance to Haman like everyone else. And when he refuses to bow down before Haman, that sets up Haman with great anger. And he decides that if Mordecai is not willing to do this, not only do I have it in for Mordecai, but I have it in for all his people. And so Haman makes plans and actually gets Xerxes to order that all of Haman's people, the Jews, were to be killed. Now, this, by the way, happens as they're casting lots, and the word that's translated as lot is pur, or the plural would be purim, from which we get the name of this festival that Judaism still celebrates, the festival of Purim. And not really precisely sure what the lots were all about. Quite possibly what it was doing was casting of lights to determine for Haman what's the right date for me to set when the Jews are supposed to be all killed wherever they're at in the Persian Empire. Well, it ends up kind of turning around that ends up being a day of the deliverance of the Jews instead of them being exterminated. As the story unfolds, Mordecai is aware of what's going to happen. He informs Esther, and so Esther sets upon a plan in order to save the people of God. And the way that she goes about this is the king offers to her, when he sees her and he's pleased to see her, that he says, ask me anything you want. And she says, well, let me throw a big feast, and I want Haman to be there as well. And when that happens, they have several days of feast, and she ends up asking what should be done for somebody that the king delights in, whom the king is very happy about. And the king ends up even asking this question of Haman, and Haman says, oh, you ought to give him the best robe and give him great prominence. Haman is thinking that this is all for him. It ends up being for Mordecai, because what happened was one night, Xerxes couldn't sleep, and so he has his chronicles read to him of all kinds of great things that had happened during his reign. And one of the accounts that came out was how Mordecai had caught wind of a conspiracy to kill Xerxes, and he had alerted the king's bodyguards and such to this, and so the king's life was spared. And Xerxes says, well, what was ever done for Mordecai for doing such a great thing for me? They say, well, nobody ever really did anything for him. So now Xerxes has it in his mind, Mordecai needs to be honored. So Haman, who had had gallows built, that he was planning on having Mordecai hanged from those gallows, instead now finds out that Xerxes wants to honor Mordecai. And in the process, on the very gallows that Haman had built, he himself is hanged. And then, as the rest of the account plays out, the date on which the Jewish people were to be killed throughout the Persian Empire, Xerxes gives an order that they are allowed to defend themselves. And in fact, when they defend themselves, they rout all of their opponents who are trying to kill them. And so here's yet another example where it is seen that the Lord is taking care of his people, because they're able to have victory over those who would have killed them.
Why is that reversal of fortunes? What was aimed at Mordecai ends up being the end of Haman. Why is that reversal of fortunes, for lack of a better term, at the end of this story so important?
Well, it gets back to the central theme of the book about how God is working behind the scenes, and he's working in order to preserve his people in accordance with his promise. You can see this again as yet another connection back to the story of Joseph. So Joseph's brothers, who sold him into slavery, and then through the process of that account, Joseph rises to prominence, and it ends up saving not only the lives of his own family in the process, but also the lives of countless others as well, so that at the end of Joseph's account, he can tell his brothers, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. Now, fortunately, Joseph's brothers were repentant, and things were able to be reconciled with them. But in this account specifically, you have, again, what was intended for evil by Haman to kill the Jewish people, the people of God, instead turns to be about their elevation. And in fact, you end up with Mordecai becoming the number two man, the right-hand man for Xerxes, number two in power within the Persian Empire. so that it ends up being, again, God preserves his people, and not only preserves them, but provides them magnificently based upon not how great they are, but based upon how good he is. God is good for his promises.
How then does the book of Esther foreshadow the work of Jesus?
Well, again, if you want to, you can go with that kind of double theme and see how that definitely flows into the life of Christ and how he is the great example of this. Now, especially with Mordecai, he is going to be killed, and not only him, but the plan is for all of the Jewish people to die along with him. In many ways, you see a big twist on that with Christ, where when it comes time for the death of Christ, it is said it's better for one man to die than for the whole nation, all the people, to die with him. And so he steps to the fore to take the death for others. Also, you can think of this, Joseph, who is going to be given into death, and yet his life is spared. You have Daniel, who is given into death in the lion's den, and yet his life is spared. Mordecai and Esther and all the people of God in the account of Esther are going to be given into death, and yet they're all spared. Christ, on the other hand, is not spared, because he is the one who suffers unjustly, but he does it for the benefit of others. And that brings us back to yet another one of those themes, is God's provision for his people, even in the midst of unjust treatment. And that is never more clear than in the life of Christ himself. Never was there one who was treated more unjustly than Christ, and yet, through it, God takes care of his people, bringing salvation through what Christ suffered.
Finally, then, how do Christians best remember the Old Testament saint Esther?
Well, let's remember her as one, a faithful woman, one who trusted that God is going to work faithfully for his people. Secondly, let's understand her also faithful in the sense of she is faithful to her very identity, that in the face of great pressure and great difficulty, she stands up and does what is good and right. And this is something that the faithful can always learn from Esther and from other faithful saints, is fortitude in the face of distress. But also, we should rightly understand that, and maybe this is the third point, is that she is God's instrument, that it is God who is working through her for the good of his people. And you can anticipate him doing the same through the saints today, all those who trust in Christ, is that God is still working through them in ways that we may not see at times, kind of behind the scenes, working through his people so that his good might be accomplished for our eternal blessing.
Dr. Kevin Golden is pastor of Village Lutheran Church in St. Louis. He has a PhD in biblical studies with an emphasis on the Old Testament from Concordia Seminary. Dr. Golden, thank you.
Always good to be with you.
On the other side of this break, it's our feature this week in Pop Christianity Today, Rick Wilkerson Jr.'s sermon on the 12 spies in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. Pastor Chris Roseborough, Fighting for the Faith, will be our guest.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
At Risen Christ Lutheran Church in Arvada, Colorado, we have simply become captivated by the hilarious notion that God has sent his Son, Jesus Christ, into the world to save the losers of this world, losers just like us. We proclaim the biblical notion that God saves sinners. Embracing the historic liturgy of the church, we confess that we are just that, sinners. Visit us online at risenchristlutheran.org.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Weddings and pandemics, that seems like an odd combination, but it's the May issue of the Lutheran Witness in sickness and in health. The church will only survive COVID-19 by focusing on Christ, who offered his life for his bride that she might be spotless. So also the bride and groom will only fulfill their wedding vows in sickness and in health by focusing on Christ and his word of forgiveness. Subscribe to the Lutheran Witness at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, cph.org/witness.
Christ-centered, cross-focused, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.